You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of June 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at RUSI. Raffaello, what do you have for us today?
Well, this morning, the top story is this story coming out of Syria, which is that we have the French and the British now saying that sarin gas may have been used. What does this mean for the sort of future of the civil war there? We have Xi Jinping in Mexico, sort of one of these big South-South meetings. And then finally, we have Myanmar, where the World Economic Forum is holding a big meeting, and Coca-Cola has started a bottling plant again.
And also on the show, we'll find out why the Chinese are getting annoyed about a military exercise in California.
Plus, we head to Israel to find out why female soldiers there are posing in their underwear.
And forget the five-star hotels and lavish dinners, there's a new breed of tourists coming your way, and they're doing some good too.
There is a lifestyle, a common lifestyle of people that are looking at participating in volunteer projects around the world.
All of that, plus we will of course play some music too. That is all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So, lots to come in the next 60 minutes. I know what story Dominic is looking forward to.
Go on.
I think it maybe involves some soldiers and underwear.
Hey, I just read what I'm told. The word underwear at the end of that sentence really took me by surprise. Wow. That is coming up, apparently, in the next hour.
And lots more with that. But before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the latest world news.
Syrian state television claims that government forces have taken control of the key town of Qusair. It's been the scene of fierce fighting in recent weeks because of its control of supply routes. Foreign ministers from across the Middle East meet today to discuss the crisis in Syria after France claimed it had evidence that government forces have used the nerve agent sarin. Meanwhile, Martin Nizeki, a spokesman for the UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon, says there's concern of mounting reports of atrocities inside Syria.
He has seen this report. Frankly, he finds the catalogue of atrocities in that report to be both sickening and staggering. The Secretary-General remains gravely concerned about any allegations of chemical weapons use by any party in Syria.
There have been more protests in Turkey, despite an attempt by the country's deputy prime minister to calm the situation. Bülent Arınç is to meet demonstrators later. Yesterday, he apologised for the violent response of police to initial protests. That led to a series of anti-government demonstrations in towns and cities across Turkey. Police again fired tear gas and used water cannon on protesters in Istanbul's Taksim Square on Tuesday night. Nawaz Sharif is being sworn in as Pakistan's prime minister later on Wednesday. It follows his victory in last month's election. It's Mr. Sharif's third term as prime minister. He's promised to concentrate on reviving Pakistan's economy and improving security. China has responded to a move by the European Union to impose tariffs on imports of Chinese solar panels. The EU acted on claims that Chinese firms have been selling below cost price, harming European manufacturers. China says the move is unfair. And Pete Sweeney, markets correspondent for Reuters in Shanghai, told us Chinese authorities are now targeting European wine imports.
China has launched an anti-dumping and anti-subsidy probe into European wine. That's a tit for tat. Chinese politicians are reaching out to the European Union and warning about that in a trade war nobody wins, and that certainly seems to be true right now.
A senior Chinese official says the country has mountains of data implicating the US in hacking attacks on China. It comes ahead of talks later this week between President Obama and the Chinese Premier Xi Jinping. Mr. Obama will tell Mr. Xi that China must act against high-tech spying on US military and other computer systems. A new report says India, Pakistan and China are all increasing their nuclear arsenals. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute says it's happening despite continued moves by the US and Russia to cut their nuclear stockpiles. Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute says mutual suspicion between India and Pakistan remains a significant problem.
Fear that you're falling behind an adversary or that your adversaries, when combined, have more than you can spur on real fear. It did that during the Cold War, and it still does that now. And if Pakistan were to find that India had 50 more warheads than it did, it would result in a sudden build-up.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul, thank you. 5 minutes past 8 a.m. Here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and the lovely Dominic Reynolds.
Oh, thanks.
It is time now for us to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Senior Research Fellow at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, Raffaello Pantucci. Raffaello, many thanks for coming into the show today.
Good morning.
Let's begin the top story everyone's really talking about, new developments in Syria and startling evidence, perhaps.
Well, I think the thing that's surprising is that we now have a French leader. The foreign minister came out and said that they have evidence that sarin gas was used in a number of instances, and they seem to be pointing the finger at the Assad regime. This comes in the heels of the British government saying much the same thing, though maybe in a slightly less pointed way. And a few days or even a week or so back, the UN saying that they had evidence that chemical weapons had been used. Now, I mean, this is significant because, you know, chemical weapons was the sort of the red line, you know, that Obama has set and said, you know, once we cross this, this is a sort of point of no return and we've got some resulting action will have to be taken. And so the question really becomes, what happens next? What is the international community actually going to do? We've now got senior leaders in the West saying this red line has supposedly been crossed and they have to react. And so the question becomes, what does that reaction and what does this mean for the broader civil war? We've seen in the last few days a number of increasingly sort of menacing signs. We've got more evidence of people coming in to fight, Hezbollah people from Lebanon, more Iranian fighters coming in. We've got all sorts of people coming from Iraq to fight on both sides of the civil war. And we've got Yusuf al-Qardawi, the sort of leader of the Sunni Muslim community in the world, telling people to go and fight there. So, I mean, this sort of civil war is slowly becoming this giant magnet that's just attracting all sorts of trouble.
And yet the one sort of factor that I guess could change this in a single stroke would be the US saying, yes, that red line has been crossed. But all of the time, the requirements of proof are being ratcheted up. Despite, you know, once upon a time, you would say a French report from a respectable set of journalists for Le Monde saying we can confirm this has happened. Mm-hmm. That would have been enough once upon a time, but it's not now.
Well, I mean, you've got the added dilemma, of course, on the other side, the Russians, who are providing surface-to-air missiles and are providing other equipment for the Assad regime. So the dilemma becomes, you know, how much does the United States or the West want to become involved in a sort of potentially kinetic battlefield where you have, on the other side, a proxy that's being supported by Iran and Russia. And it starts to really drag you into a conflict that is potentially has very dangerous repercussions.
And this, of course, is happening all ahead of these crucial peace talks, which are happening in Geneva later this month. What's your prediction, Raffaello, of what's going to come out of that meeting? Is it just going to be more talk, or do you think we're actually going to see substantial developments there?
Well, I have to be honest and say that I'm worried that we're going to see more talk. I think the other news that I think was at the top of your news bulletin is this news out of Qusair, where the regime seems to be taking back this city from the rebels and they seem to be getting pushed out. So you've got a regime that's clearly been going into these talks with quite a strong sense that they're in a good position. So at what point are they going to want to give way? On the other side, the rebels will, you know, are still not really that coherent a force. You've still got the sort of Islamists and you've still got the secularists and it's still a very fragmented side. So, you know, I don't necessarily see that we have the parameters that have been set for actually having a discussion which will lead to a sort of peaceful resolution.
And there's a lot of talk about that, you know, the problem being no sort of coherent sort of form on the opposition side. Mm. But I suppose the lack of coherence is in the international community as well, isn't it? You know, France and Britain wanting to put weapons in the US, less so Russia, of course, on a totally different tack.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's no prospect at this point of those sorts of aims coming together, is
there? Yeah, I mean, there was some optimism coming out of the fact that Secretary Kerry's visit to Moscow had gone quite well, and it seemed as though the Russians seemed to be willing to try to come to the table to discuss what could be done. But it's not clear to me that there was actually any tangible output for that, or if it was just a sort of discussion tactic, you know, keep the talks going without necessarily seeing a sort of end point to this process.
And another story that's grabbed the headlines is the visit today of the Chinese President Xi Jinping in Mexico. He's meeting his counterpart there, Peña Nieto.
Well, this is, we spoke about this. I spoke about this with, I think, Andrew earlier in the week. Xi Jinping is in the middle of a big Latin America trip. He went to Costa Rica and I've forgotten the other country right now. But he went to Costa Rica, and Mexico is the last stop on this tour of Latin America. And it is particularly significant because this sort of Chinese-Mexican relationship has always been slightly tense.
Trinidad and Tobago.
There we go. It's
just a mere 8 seconds later, the answer to your question. Okay.
Well, this is how switched on we are, right?
Yes,
the visit to Mexico is significant because they have an interesting relationship. You know, the Mexicans in some ways can provide a lot of the sort of manufacturing base that the sort of Chinese are very good at, you know, have managed to undercut and everyone else. But in Mexico, say, labor costs are still quite cheap. And especially when you're looking at the American market, which is adjacent to them. So, you know, instead of having to stick on a boat across the world, you can just sort of drive it up across the border. So they've always had this slightly tense relationship. But Peña Nieto seems to have come in and said, let's try to put this slightly tense relationship behind us and try to build this sort of stronger trade relationship. Mexico is one of the countries in the region which recognizes Beijing over Taipei. So they have that sort of close bond. And, you know, Xi Jinping sort of making this, I think, this is his second big international trip, and making it to a series of countries right in sort of Latin America like this, I think demonstrates the importance of these large sort of what I describe as South-South relationships to the Chinese administration.
And they want to, certainly Peña Nieto wants to rebalance that trade deficit.
Yeah.
How do you, it's a fairly substantial one.
It's 57 billion versus 5.7.
Yeah, so there we go. It's sort of round numbers we're dealing with, I suppose. But how do they go about that? What are the steps that you try and take?
Well, one of the things that have been discussed, the Chinese have advanced, is the idea of creating a sort of free trade area to try to do some sort of agreement between the two, whereby therefore trade will be easier to send back and forth. At the moment, it's one of these quite traditional relationships where the Chinese sort of sell lots of products, and the Mexicans export some sort of natural resources. Well, there are some Mexican products that might be competitive and could be attractive to the Chinese market. And as I say, maybe some of the bigger questions about the fact that Chinese labor costs are going up, costs in general in China are sort of increasing on some manufacturing goods. It's possible that some of these goods might actually start flowing the other way.
And another story which has grabbed your attention involves Coca-Cola, a sign that maybe things are finally starting to head in the right direction, perhaps, for Burma.
Well, this is, I think, another sort of significant story that has been talked about a lot recently, and it's the sort of slow opening up of Myanmar, or Burma, whichever name you choose. And this comes on the back of the fact that they're holding a World Economic Forum meeting in Naypyidaw, the sort of new capital that the generals built. And at the same time as this, they're also announcing the opening of a Coca-Cola plant there. Coca-Cola is, you know, a big Western American brand. It's sort of a symbol of, you know, a free market, if you will. And so it's significant that the company has sort of decided to open there. They put a $200 million five-year investment. And I think this is really emblematic of the sort of big surge you've seen of interest towards Burma. Or Myanmar, in the past few years, as the country has slowly opened up and Western companies have started to look at the market.
I mean, I guess one of the questions is, it is fast, very fast. The reforms that have been put in place and the opening up of global trade, consequently, is there a question mark over quite how fast it is?
Yes.
And, you know, given, you know, the situation in the country can only change so quickly.
Yeah. I think there's a very big question there. I think you put your finger on the button. I mean, a lot of the sort of the groundwork, if you will, in Myanmar simply isn't there. I mean, I've spoken to business people who've been out there, and they tell me, you know, sort of like internet penetration is only about 5%. Mobile telephony covers about 10% of the country. And I might be getting those figures slightly wrong, but the point is that they're very low. The infrastructure is not really existent. Now, a company like Coca-Cola, the product they're producing is when you have a bottling plant outside a major city, you know, you can put it into trucks and then just shuttle it around the country. But if you're talking about sort of bigger investments, it's still a very early market and still at a very sort of nascent stage. And so I think, you know, a lot of this push that you've seen is, I think, going to be slowing down in the next over the next year as companies really start to actually evaluate the practicalities of what will be feasible to do there.
And because there have been lots of human rights criticisms that are continuing. Obama recently welcomed the leader of Myanmar just 2 weeks ago. Abe canceling some of its debt to Myanmar. But people are saying you're forgetting about the human rights problems that still exist in the country. You know, it's all well and good to open up the doors for investment, but what are you actually going to do to fix the fundamental problems that are happening still?
Yeah, I mean, you've still got a substantial number of minorities in various border parts of the country who are, in the middle of sort of conflicts with the government. And yes, it is a big question. I mean, the plight of the Rohingya Muslims in the country is one which gets a lot less coverage than it should, frankly. There's an awful lot of terrible things happening down there that are just not getting attention. But the dilemma becomes, you know, on the one hand, this government has shown a willingness to start to open up and start to reform. And at the same time, it does have all these domestic problems. And so I think from a Western government perspective, how much do you want to push very hard for them to sort of abruptly, dramatically change and maybe try to, and what will that mean for the sort of coherence of the state and the ability of it to continue versus maybe trying to find a way of, helping them overcome some of these human rights problems through a reform process rather necessarily than a sort of abrupt change.
Raffaello Pantucci, we will have to leave it there. Senior research fellow, at RUSI. Thank you very much for joining us.
And coming up in just a moment, we'll be asking why the Chinese are unhappy about a military exercise taking place in California.
The menu brings you the culinary stories and tales that are sure to inspire. From cake, steak and tapas to oysters, chicken and caviar, the menu roams the world in search of the best things to eat and the best places to eat them in. We uncover the trends that are taking hold and interview those spearheading a gastronomic movement.
The spirit in there represents the legacy of everything where we have been involved in the rum-making business. You have to taste it to believe it.
Okay, can we take Peruvian food back to London? A different type of corns, you know, a different type of cheese. And I knew at that stage, yeah, this is good.
So if you don't know the difference between a Salzburger Knockel and Kolonskink, a head cheese and a Faluda, tune into the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time. I hope you're hungry.
That's The Menu, in association with Crew.
You're back with Midori House. Now, it's taking place 8,000 miles away in California, but a military exercise the US has planned is making China very nervous indeed. That's because American troops will be joined by Japanese soldiers to practice the retaking of remote islands. And given that China and Japan continue to fight over the disputed Senkaku Diaoyu Islands, this distant bit of military practice is a very close-up concern in Beijing.
And if that wasn't tense enough, the exercise is due to take place just a few days after a summit in California between Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping. Well, to help us unpick this increasingly complicated security triangle, we're joined in the studio by John Hemmings. He's a research fellow at the Pacific Forum CSIS. Many thanks for coming on the program. Let's begin. This really is an unprecedented level of participation by the Japanese military in these military exercises with the Americans.
Yes, it is. But I don't think we should push that point too much. It comes both as a yes, there is an aspect of developing amphibious for Japan, which has to do with the island maritime disputes, but it also has to do with the tsunami in which Japan found itself very hard pressed to get troops and supplies and helpers to different parts of the Japanese archipelago that were affected by the tsunami.
That's interesting. So can you give us an idea of exactly what this exercise will be doing? You know, physically, what will they... clearly, they are preparing for more than just the sort of political story that's come out of this.
Well, it's this exercise happens regularly. It's not something that's just coming out of the blue. But the Japanese participation is what's new. Essentially, what it involves is marine capabilities, the ability to land people on a shore and to work within 60 miles of the shoreline. So traditional armies and navies have always fought over that role, and so Marines have always been given that capability. It's a kind of singular, separate service a lot of times in the military. And so in this case, the Japanese just don't have it. They don't have the coordination between their armies and navy. They're very hard-pressed to be able to move people along ships and have these kind of doctrine in place. So it's part of developing that skill set.
And as we also heard earlier, Obama and Xi Jinping will be meeting on Friday in D.C. What kind of a message do these military exercises, what kind of message are they trying to send out, perhaps, to Xi Jinping?
Well, you can take two points of view. On the one hand, they're not doing the exercises in the location of the Senkaku Island, so they've tried to avoid some provocation. On the other hand, they are happening in California just before Xi Jinping. There might be a deterrence signal at effect. In other words, do not try to take these islands by force. And Chinese, I guess, patrols around the islands have gone from, you know, zero a year to the current, like, around the clock. So there might be a kind of Japanese, particularly under this Abe government, a Japanese messaging through these exercises, through their participation to China.
And yet, the, you know, as you say, this happens regularly. The Japanese involvement is part of the thing that's new. You know, it has many applications beyond that specific, you know, hypothetical dispute. So you would imagine then that the Chinese response could be pretty measured, but it hasn't been that measured, has it?
I mean, well, it's hard to say. I mean, I've been actually scouring the Chinese language newspapers, and the front lines aren't dominated by it. So it's not like Beijing's really hitting this. I think we've seen a few of the stories have come up. And I think one of the things that probably Asahi have taken issue with is why a third country should take issue with two sovereign countries having an exercise, not even in their neighborhood. Really, I can see the perspective of the Japanese on this. The other thing that's behind all this context is, how do you deal with a rising power that wants to change the status quo on its periphery, particularly who owns what, and is not willing to do that diplomatically? You want to show that force is out of the question. And I think exercises tend to be the way that people do it. They say, if you take this, there will be a price.
Well, do you think we could expect a similar kind of message then from the Chinese in their own subtle way? Are they known for having these large-scale military exercises? Could we potentially see that happening in the coming weeks in response to this?
Indeed, maybe not in response, but I would be very surprised if you didn't. All around the region, you're seeing these exercises used more and more as deterrents. One of the famous ones I was thinking of on my way here was when Robert Gates went to China in 2008, I believe it was, January. The Chinese PLA, on the day he was supposed to meet with the Chinese leadership, they unveiled the new stealth aircraft. Often in January, they also test new anti-satellite systems, which are aimed primarily at U.S. platforms. So, yeah, there's always this kind of messaging that says, you know, back off. In whether or not the Chinese will be able to control the public opinion in response to these exercises is another matter.
Well, yeah, I mean, the timing just seems, it seems improbable that there isn't some level of planning in this. And I suppose if I were a fly on the wall in that meeting in a few days' time, when China comes to California, so to speak, I would be interested in whether or not the exercise that was planned would undermine that meeting entirely.
Well, remember, that meeting it's not going to be a happy-go-lucky meeting. It's definitely very much going to be dominated by soothing tensions. So perhaps, although I doubt that exercises, which are usually arranged by militaries and have long bureaucratic planning processes, I doubt it's the kind of messaging that we imagine in this studio. But on the other hand, I can see that it will at least send a message to Xi Jinping, who's a very strong leader right now. You know, this is not something you can take by force. Please rethink your strategy of how you want to negotiate these islands.
This question might be a bit out in left field, but is this perhaps the start of a 21st century version of the Cold War, for example, that we're used to between Russia and the Americans? Is this a new, perhaps evolved version of that between China and the United States?
It could go that way. I've been thinking along the lines, and a lot of other kind of policy people who work on the region are kind of concerned with that. And I think a lot of people in China are concerned with it. One of the reasons that Xi Jinping and Barack Obama are sitting down are to deal with these issues and see, you know, beyond the point of where they compete, how can they keep the cooperation up and the competition down? You saw cyber in North Korea were high on the menu. Cybersecurity is becoming a huge issue. And to be honest, it's leading the way in this Cold War kind of mindset on both parts.
Excellent stuff. John Hemmings there, research fellow at the Pacific Forum from CSIS. Many thanks for coming on the program. It was great to have you
Thank
on.
You.
And be sure to tune in next week for our special week-long series on the Senkaku Islands. You can listen to that from Monday on The Globalist at 6 o'clock in the morning, London time.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
От Лондон, това е Monocle 24.
Фра Лондон, дете е Monocle 24.
From London, дете Лондон.
Оланда.
Лондон, Европа.
Хонконг.
Хонконг.
Зюрих.
Лондон.
This is Monocle 24.
Now, thick colours, fantastical visions, violin playing goats.
Oh my.
I know. This is the world of, Phil?
Marc Chagall.
Correct.
A favourite of yours, right?
Yeah, I would say so. I think we're going to learn something. Now, he was one of the most celebrated artists of the 20th century, of course, and since February, Kunsthaus Zurich have been exhibiting a show that explores Chagall's development from the naive folklore narratives of his early work towards that signature style, a combination of cubism, expressionism, all through a Jewish-Russian prism.
And this Saturday, the exhibition will open its doors at the Tate, Liverpool. It will be the first major presentation of the Russian painter's work in the UK for more than 15 years, providing an opportunity to see the depth and diversity of Chagall's art. Well, joining us now on the program is Stephanie Strain. She's the curator of the exhibition. Stephanie, many thanks for joining us here on Midori House. First big question, you know, this is the first major exhibition of his work in more than 15 years. How did the Tate Liverpool get so lucky to actually, you know, have this exhibition?
Well, I think it was really a dialogue between Tate Liverpool and Kunsthaus Zurich as institutions. And we were also lucky to have an external curator on board who was really driving the thesis of the show, Simonetta Fraccelli. And Simonetta previously worked at the Royal Academy, who hosted the last two major Chagall shows in 98 and 85. So she brought with her this wealth of experience and knowledge about handling the various collections and the art historical literature on Chagall. So we were lucky in that respect. But I think it was really Tate's sort of position in Liverpool as the sort of art of the North, bringing really major survey shows to Liverpool and sort of really bringing important art outside of London. Because obviously you're saying it's the first show in 15 years, but it's definitely the first time that the Northwest of England has had a major Chagall show. So we're really trying to kind of bring these sort of major artists outside of London.
Stephanie, I wonder, in that introduction, I talked about, you know, the sort of fantasy visions and, of course, the violin playing goats. That's the sort of popular impression of Chagall. Is that sort of that popular impression missing something? What else is there to discover, perhaps from the earlier years?
Well, I think you're right. Our focus is really very tight. It's on around 1911 to 1920, the first real decade of his artistic career. And what we're trying to show in this really sort of tight focus is that rather than just being seen as kind of quite an idiosyncratic, isolated figure, you know, this kind of remote genius who develops this sort of very unique language of art, we wanted to place Chagall in the context of the other major avant-garde figures of the time. So this is why this decade is so important, because he spends 2 years in Paris completely connected to what's going on in the salons, what people were showing there, the development of cubism and orphism. And then when he returns to Russia at the outbreak of the First World War, he begins working as a commissar of fine art in his hometown, and ends up working with major avant-garde figures like Elizabeth and Malevich. So he comes into contact with suprematism and constructivism at the moment of their genesis, essentially. So all of this really contributed to his artistic development, and it sort of, we're trying to flag up the immediacy of his encounter with these sort of really pivotal developments in the history of modernism.
And Stephanie, during that decade, much of his work centered around particular themes. So he focused on things like love, suffering, death. What was it about this decade of work, do you think, that still resonates with an audience today?
Well, I think he really manages to articulate emotion through painting. He seems to achieve in this decade, where he's still very young, he's under 30 for most of it, a kind of intensity through a use of paint handling and colour, which is quite remarkable. And obviously he returns to Russia at a moment when the war is happening, but then in a couple of years it's the Russian Revolution. And all of this is obviously contributes to an incredibly tumultuous period for him personally, but for the country as well. And also important to our show in particular is the emphasis that Chagall places on his Jewish identity within his painting. So we have a lot of work from this period where he's really exploring explicitly Jewish themes at a moment when Eastern European Judaism was increasingly under threat, and it was incredibly difficult for Chagall to witness what was happening to his people both in Russia and elsewhere. So I think this kind of idea of suffering takes place not just on a personal level, but he sees it as relating to a much wider culture.
Stephanie Strain, the curator of the Chagall Modern Master exhibition, which opens this Saturday at the Tate Liverpool. Many thanks for coming on Midori House. Appreciate that. Dominic, we're going to have to head up to Liverpool, perhaps. You game for that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, check out a bit of Chagall.
When are we going?
I'll let you know. You're listening to Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Now, in the next half hour of the programme, while Phil and I cement our travel plans, we'll be also heading to Israel to find out why female soldiers are posing in their underwear.
Don't get flustered.
I know. It's okay. Again, that word at the end of the... I mean, we've been trailing it since the top of the show. When is this item coming? And we'll also discuss a new breed of tourist, the voluntourist. Paul Osborne first. He's got the news headlines.
Reports on Syrian state television claim government forces have now taken control of the key town of Qusayr. Those reports haven't yet been independently verified, but the town has been the scene of fierce fighting in recent weeks. Foreign ministers from across the Middle East are meeting today to discuss the crisis in Syria after France claimed it had evidence that government forces have used the nerve agent sarin. China has responded to a move by the European Union to impose tariffs on imports of Chinese solar panels. The EU acted on claims that Chinese firms are selling below cost price, though China, which says the move is unfair, has in retaliation announced an investigation into European wine imports. There have been more protests in Turkey, despite an attempt by the country's deputy prime minister to calm the situation. Bülent Arınç is to meet demonstrators later after apologising yesterday for the violent response of police to initial protests. Nawaz Sharif's being sworn in as the new prime minister of Pakistan. It's his third term as prime minister. He's promised to concentrate on reviving the Pakistani economy and improving security. And a senior Chinese official says the country has mountains of data implicating the US in hacking attacks on China. It comes ahead of talks later this week between President Obama and the Chinese Premier Xi Jinping. Mr. Obama is expected to tell him that China must act against high-tech spying on US targets. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:32 a.m. here in London, 10:32 in Jerusalem. That's where we're heading now. Joseph Dana is with us. Hi, Joseph. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, I think. I'm intrigued by a story about an amusement park in Israel. What's this about?
Well, there is an amusement park called Superland just outside of Tel Aviv, and a Palestinian school teacher from Jaffa arranged to have her class visit the amusement park about 2 weeks ago and was told that she was not able to go because there would be a Jewish student group at the same time. And it turns out that this amusement park had actually been segregating which days Jewish and Arab students were allowed to partake in the festivities at the park. And this has led to a very big conversation in Israeli society about segregation and its role in Israeli society.
Well, what's the reaction been like there in Israel? I understand that it's even reached the Knesset.
Indeed. Tzipi Livni, the justice minister, asked for a very prompt investigation into this issue of segregation. And there's been a pretty harsh backlash, kind of surprisingly, because Israel is a very segregated society. There's a lot of kind of segregation that just goes under the surface. And so when something like this kind of bubbles up and catches the media's attention, then people get very angry. And so we'll see what happens with the Knesset investigation and whether or not this policy will actually change.
Joseph, let's jet to the Paris Air Show and a change in the Israeli presence there this time round.
Absolutely. In 2011, the Israelis actually sponsored a 1,000-square-meter pavilion at the air show, kind of trumping up the Israeli defense export industry. And this year, it seems as though they're cutting back, they're tightening their belts, and they're sending a lot less delegations to the air show to kind of promote this industry. Now, this is very interesting considering the health of the Israeli defense export industry. It's just been reported that Israeli drones have totaled something like $4.6 billion in profits over the last 8 years. That's about $580 million a year that Israel's making off of these drones. And it's, in fact, the largest exporter of drone technology in the world at this moment. And so we see the kind of pinches of the economy, you know, really nipping at the heels of the defense industry while people are very interested in Israeli tech and Israeli kind of defense exports.
So is that the main reason then that these defense companies are tightening their belts, so to speak, even though they're having what seems to be boomer years in terms of exports?
It appears that way. There was a very interesting interview in the Israeli Business Daily called Globes with the outgoing Albit CEO. Albit is one of the major defense corporations in Israel. And he argued that the industry really needs to consolidate itself in Israel, that there's too many small players that are kind of cutting up the pie too much, and that this could lead to some very dramatic economic effects on the Israeli defense industry. And so it seems as though Israel's kind of going through its own penny-pinching kind of maneuvers, and it's also responding to the global market and seeing that there's not necessarily as much of a desire for all of the kind of defense technology that Israel can offer, but there's much more of a desire in the drone kind of arena, and so they're going to focus efforts on that.
Joseph, let's talk about the Eritrean refugees. They sort of have come up in various stories, in various forms, in the last few years. Clearly, it's a sort of a demographic that Israel struggles with politically a little bit. And then a bit of a development on this story now.
Absolutely. The situation of African migrants in Israel, African refugees, is really one of the most contentious issues in Israeli society outside of the conflict and issue with the Palestinians. And so roughly 60,000 African refugees are living mostly in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem that have been coming in from countries like Eritrea and from countries like Sudan, kind of fleeing the violence there through Egypt into Israel. And so there's been some very interesting developments on this situation in which Israel has seemingly agreed to kind of export or deport its Eritrean refugee community to an unknown or unnamed East African country. Now, there's been some rumors that Israel actually offered to pay this country to take these people, which is really, kind of unbelievable and setting a very amazing precedent. But it does seem as though these refugees are going to start to be deported to this unnamed third African country. According to various international legal resolutions, Israel is not really able to deport these refugees back to Eritrea because of the situation there. And so it looks like it's trying to solve this problem by just unloading them somewhere in Africa. And this has created another very, very contentious and emotional debate as to how Israel looks at refugees that are not of Jewish origin.
And Joseph, I'm curious to know, away from the refugee issue, what's Israel's relationship with immigrant populations there? Is there a growing nationalistic movement, perhaps, that many parts of Europe are seeing?
Absolutely. There is a very, very strong, let's say, nationalist right-wing kind of movement against these refugees. Now, last year, an Israeli Knesset member actually likened these refugees to a cancer on Israeli society. And when that statement hit the press and there was a real, kind of outcry about it, the Knesset member actually apologized to cancer survivors for likening them to Africans. And so this is some of the climate that exists in places like Tel Aviv and Jerusalem about these refugees, and is creating a real crisis in Israeli society. And so it seems as though the government is taking these drastic measures to even pay third countries to take these people out of Israeli society. And this is going to be a long issue that's going to kind of plague Israel's social climate for many years to come.
Joseph, I'm going to move on to the last story that, and Phil and I have been taking it relatively lightly, and I guess there is no other way that you can take a photo that I'm looking at, which is four topless women with their backs to the camera of differing heights, wearing underwear and also wearing machine guns across their buttocks. Where did this photo come from?
Well, this is the latest in a very interesting series of soldiers, photos of Israeli soldiers in very kind of compromising positions, let's say. One thing that we have to keep in mind about the Israeli military, which most people don't really think about, is that a lot of soldiers carry smartphones with them. If you run into a patrol of soldiers in the West Bank, chances are each of those soldiers is going to have an iPhone in their pocket. And we know that, you know, patrolling the West Bank and being in these military kind of situations does kind of breed a certain boredom. And so we've seen this very interesting relationship between soldiers and social media. And so last week, a photos of female soldiers, scantily clad, but with machine guns and clearly in or partly in Israeli military fatigues, were posted on Facebook, and they immediately went viral. And like I said, this is the latest in a series of these kind of photos, either on Facebook or on Twitter or on even on YouTube, and they kind of just keep trickling out of the Israeli military. And it does provide a very interesting commentary as to what people are actually doing.
It is actually interesting, Joseph, that you mentioned that, because the Israeli Defense Force actually have a unit in the military that's dedicated to using social media. So, you know, they have a social media command center, even, so to speak, during times of conflict.
Absolutely. We saw this during the last Gaza conflict, in which the Israeli military immediately went to all various platforms of social media, including Pinterest, which I thought was about baking and restaurants and whatnot. And so they're really, you know, kind of taking over every avenue of social media. And I guess we're seeing one of the consequences of this, in which you have a lot of young people that have access to social media and are in situations in which there's a lot of free time. And so young people end up doing irresponsible things. And in the case of the Israeli military, they seem to think it's a funny or good idea to post pictures of themselves scantily clad with machine guns. And so the world finds this very, very interesting indeed.
And presumably, however despicable everybody finds it, they still go and have a quick look at the pictures just to check that it is as despicable as they thought it was. Joseph Dana in Jerusalem, thank you very much.
And Dominic, I'll give you my copies of the photos so you can, if you want to take those home.
Got
I don't
own.
Know if you want to.
Got,
well, you could always use a couple. You can
why not?
Spread it around your
a couple
home,
in
perhaps.
Each room, huh?
Yeah. You are listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hunt, and Dominic Reynolds. We'll be back right after this with a tour of a fresco restoration project in Italy.
Mayors, urban visionaries, big city thinkers, corporate honchos, and some rebels too, are packing their bags and heading to the New Cities Summit in Sao Paulo. This epic meeting of metropolis makers is where the future of our cities will be revealed, debated, and plotted. And Monocle 24 will be there to ask the big questions about how we can all make a better place to call home. Join me, Andrew Tuck, for two special outings of The Globalist Asia on Tuesday, June the 4th and Wednesday the 5th, as we broadcast live from the heart of the debate.
Sintonize a Monocle 24, às 4 horas da tarde, horário de São Paulo, nos dias 4 e 5 de junho, para programa ao vivo, especial direto do New City Summit, no auditório do Ibirapuera.
Discover what your urban future looks like, which cities are the big losers, and who's getting it right. 2000 hours London time and 1600 hours in Sao Paulo. Join me.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds, where the time here in London is 8:43.
Now, this week on The Entrepreneurs, we'll meet the people behind a company using design and hospitality to come up with an ideal environment for creative businesses. We'll test out an innovative crowdfunding platform for startups in Dresden, and we'll get business tips from one of India's most influential businesswomen, Priya Paul.
But in this preview, we're in Italy. The Voluntourist is a new breed of traveller, still taking in the culture, but giving back to the community via various volunteer projects worldwide. Lucy Hillsop travelled to a fresco restoration project in Puglia, Italy, to speak with Vancouverite Aaron Smith, who's turned this phenomenon into a thriving business.
The local shepherd is crying out to round up his flock of 100 or so sheep and goats in the hills just outside of Altomora in Puglia. They're meandering around the rocky landscape and embarrassment of Neolithic tombs, while a group of American, Canadian, Italian and English volunteers from a local fresco restoration project takes a break to stroll and chat with him. Over a traditional lunch of soup, bread and cheese, it's clear the interaction during the 10-day trip is hitting the spot.
My name is Gabriele Troppani. I'm 26 years old. I came from Palermo, Sicily. I live in Brussels and I'm a filmmaker. I hate traditional tourism and I love to do something. All my trips are in a way that I should do something for me, for the others. And it's a kind of good match point between enjoy the landscape, enjoy the beauty of the country, and in the same moment do something for you and for the others.
Part sightseeing, part hands-on work, it's holidaying with a difference as created by Vancouver entrepreneur Aaron Smith, who established a portal for these types of travellers to connect with volunteer projects worldwide, now totalling more than 4,000. Back down at La Salva Masseria, an 18th century lodge that doubles as the HQ for this Messors project, art restorer Tonio Crianza works on a fresco demo, as Smith explains how his business started after first volunteering abroad as part of his commerce degree.
My beginning thoughts, I should probably preface that with that I don't know if I had too many beginning thoughts. There was never a design to this business. How it started was with a microfinance project in East Africa that worked with women entrepreneurs on the ground. And we joined them for a few weeks and then did a great deal of follow-up work. But the objective was to help women develop community projects that lifted their little, often very small local villages. Those could have been chicken farmers or seamstresses, people pressing coconut oil. It was the first experience I'd ever had where I'd had a travel-based holiday, if you will, that had a purpose and left me feeling quite positive with the impacts that we were able to achieve on the ground. So I brought that back home to Canada and thought long and hard about what an experience I'd had and if that could be replicated somehow and what that would look like.
What that ended up looking like was the combination of seeing the sights while giving up part of your time on ventures, whether in an orphanage in Guatemala or lion rehabilitation in Africa, found on his Go Volunteering website and its new offshoot, Holidays for Humanity. Already then in marketing for high-end tourism, Smith spent 2 years sussing out projects and building the website.
The monetization of this site, or the goal, was in recognition that this is a travel community at the end of the day. They have to go from A to B, and they have to stay places, and they might need insurance, and they might need, you know, pre or post accommodation. So within all of those different models or revenue drivers, there's commission or margin that's available. So that was really how I thought I could solve all of this need, and in doing so, also become financially sustainable. Holidays for Humanity is now the recognition that there is a lifestyle. There's a common lifestyle of people that are looking at participating in volunteer projects around the world. And they're the same type of people that look at, now this is from a more commercial angle, but the same type of people that look at yoga resorts or health and wellness retreats. I'll keep coming back to traveling with a purpose. It's different than going to an all-inclusive or Ibiza just so you can hit pause and belly up to the bar. It's actually has an applied aspect to the travel. And they're often the same person. So we've recognized that and are looking at building a travel community that is more along the lines to, or probably best illustrated with an organic grocery store version in the travel space. So it will be volunteerism will have a part of it, as will health and wellness and sustainable expeditions and tours, LEED certified hotels and eco resorts, as well as cultural and culinary holidays that are purposeful.
His commerce degree and experience in the industry obviously helped. But Smith felt his motivation for going into this business was more emotional.
I don't think my business acumen had anything to do with it. I think it was just understanding my risk threshold and feeling that I could get behind something 100% and be passionate about it. And also understanding that, knowing that even if I failed, if I couldn't make this work, if it wasn't going to be here 18 months from now, that I would have still worked and contributed to building some school somewhere and saving some sea turtles somewhere and helping save some frescoes from further deteriorating in a place like Puglia.
We catch up with the restoration group, which has downed their pickaxes and other tools to join locals inside a 14th century crypt for a spot of lamb cooked in a clay pot. Judging by the voluntourists' enthusiasm, and unabashed dance moves during a sing-song with local musician Maria Marimarco. It seems the feeling Smith first had in Africa is spreading fast. For Monocle, in Puglia, this is Lucy Hislop.
And for more business reports from around the globe, tune in to The Entrepreneurs tonight at 1900 hours London time. Phil Nice dancing.
Yeah, did you like that?
It's sort of more, it's shoulder-based dancing.
Well, because I'm seated, so I can't really get, you know, the hips grooving. And
yeah, I mean, I can see quite a lot of motion in your shoulders,
yeah,
you know.
I'm good. Yeah. Wait, do you see me on the dance floor?
Really?
Maybe when we go up to Liverpool for that Chagall exhibition, we can throw in a little bit of...
date you've apparently arranged.
Okay. Never know. We'll be reviewing the Nordic Papers in just a moment with our Marcus Hippie. But before that, here is music from Bjork. Here's Human Behavior. And a bit of Bjork there with Human Behavior. Dom, I saw you're more of a swaying kind of guy.
You've got a sway
chair.
To that, though, really? Haven't you? That's more of a sway, definitely more of a sway vibe.
I like the shoulder shuffle.
I don't think you can to Bjork. That's the thing. We'll have to try.
Okay. Liverpool, here we come.
Okay. You're listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds, and worryingly, Phil Hahn, too. It's 8:53 a.m. here in London, 10:53 in Helsinki. Marcus Hippie joins us now in the studio to discuss Nordic newspapers. Hi, Marcus.
Hello, Dom. Hello, Phil.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
Well, I think we're pretty good, actually, so far. Yeah, Phil?
Very well. It's gorgeous weather here in London. We've been having some unseasonably warm weather. Has it come from Lapland?
I don't know. How much can you talk about the weather? Finland's been
pretty much all day long.
Finland's been experiencing this weird heat wave that doesn't really normally happen. A few days ago, Lapland had the highest temperature ever recorded, 31.7 degrees over there. Reindeer farmers are wondering what to do with the reindeers because they just don't really know how to relate to that weather. And I think it's interesting the Finnish abroad to this is always really concerned and worried. I was watching breakfast television before I came here, Finnish breakfast television, and there was an expert telling what to do when it's really hot. Once again.
They're not sort of celebrating.
No, they're not at all. They are these patronising experts telling you that you should remember to drink water, and if it's really hot, just go inside.
Could we expect perhaps a tourism boom out there in Lapland?
I think
it's been hotter than parts of the Mediterranean.
Exactly. I think it's very good PR for Lapland. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to last that much longer. But I think, you know, if the world kind of notices that it's not always cold in Finland, that's actually something I'm trying to emphasize here as well. It's not always cold in there. Actually, the summer is relatively warm, actually quite often warmer than in the UK, for example.
This is the sort of one-man meteorological PR campaign for your homeland. Thanks,
yeah,
Marcus.
Yeah, by me and Finnish Weather Institute. Shall we move to Sweden? There's actually quite a historical moment from there. One of the biggest Swedish companies, IKEA, has announced that IKEA founder Ingvar Kamprad is actually leaving one of his most influential roles with that furniture giant. He's actually basically going to retire, and one of his sons is going to take over. Mattias Kamprad is going to be the new chairman of Inter IKEA Holding.
He really has done quite an astounding job with the company, hasn't he?
Absolutely amazing. He started the company when he was 17, so he's been working with IKEA for about 70 years. And when you think how IKEA has taken over the world, you're struggling to find a country with no IKEA. So I think that's really amazing. And at the same time, I think it's very influential for Sweden as well. It's not one of those cool companies that you go bragging about that, you know, IKEA is from your country. But on the other hand, IKEA doesn't hide its Swedishness either. I quite like the idea you go to IKEA and you can actually get Swedish meatballs from there.
And of course, they're well known for having everything named after as a Swedish name, doesn't it? And during the break, Dom and I were looking through our
so
Swedish
childish.
Name generator.
There is a Swedish furniture IKEA. Name generator that you can do. Marcus, I'm doing you now. Okay, Marcus, I'm going to spell it right with a K. Your name is Marcus with a double K, but you
it's not with double K, it's just one K.
You're a fashionable chair.
Am I?
Yeah.
I thought I would be a shelf.
You feel like a shelf. Phil, you've actually changed. Phil, you're a low bed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was a small desk.
And just spelled F-I-L. There you go.
Okay, let's focus.
Shall we return to my home country, Finland? I've been slightly annoyed by what's going on over there in the design front. Marimekko is one of the most famous Finnish brands. It's a design company, mostly about textiles, and their patterns are pretty famous around the world, and they actually carry a lot of significance for Finnish people. I grew up wearing Marimekko and Marimekko patterns, for example, as so many other Finns. And now it turns out that one of their prints has actually been plagiarized. It's actually originally by a Ukrainian artist.
Ouch.
And Finns have been just wearing these and buying these for about 5 years until it turned out that actually it's not by this Finnish designer at all.
I presume the fact that this has come out is an indicator of the fact that this particular design was a bit of a hit, that lots of people were wearing
it. It's been doing well. It's been doing, as a matter of fact, so well that this same print has been now painted to the side of Finnair's A330 plane that flies to Tokyo and so. And now they had to just cover
that. They're covering it up.
They've covered it now. And Marimekko has obviously apologized, but also their PR control is not working that well. I could have a word or two with their PR managers who was dealing with this. There was absolutely no announcements from Marimekko for a few days. It seemed like they didn't know what to do. And now they have announced, finally, after 5 days or so, that they are trying to buy the rights to these prints from this Ukrainian artist.
Who I presume will give it to them for a song now, very cheaply.
Undoubtedly.
What are the prints, very quickly? What do they look like?
They look like trees, green trees. How would you describe this yourself?
Green trees.
Green trees and bushes on the white background.
Yeah. Okay. Wow, and that adorned the Finnair Finn, did it? Extraordinary. Yeah, it's very nice. Well, I hope they find an adequate replacement if they can't pay for that one. I'm glad to see you offering more PR advice to your homeland.
Well, unfortunately, though, that is all the time we have for today's show. Thanks to our producers, the very talented Annabelle Bly and the lovely Barbara Feeney. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was the very efficient Alex Funnel. Up next, after the news, is The Menu with the man himself, Marcus Hippie. Emma Nelson and I will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, but from me, Phil Hunt.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds.
Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.